Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising. This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 8th of January, these are our main stories. President Trump says any American military action against Iran will comply with international law after he was heavily criticized for threatening to bomb cultural sites. There's been chaos at Venezuela's National Assembly, where the opposition leader Juan Guaido and his supporters broke through a security cordon to enter the building. The number of people killed by a measles epidemic in the Democratic Republic of Congo has passed 6,000. Also in this podcast,
about 9,000 light years long, and this mass of gas is the site where stars are forming.
A discovery sheds new light on our galaxy. President Trump has backed down from his repeated threat to target Iranian cultural sites if Tehran retaliates following the killing last week of General Qasem Soleimani. After warnings that such attacks could constitute a war crime, Mr. Trump said if that was the case, he would obey the law.
We are, according to various laws, supposed to be very careful with their cultural heritage. And you know what? If that's what the law is, I like to obey the law. But think of it. They kill our people. They blow up our people. And then we have to be very gentle with their cultural institutions. But I'm okay with it. It's okay with me.
The general was killed on Friday in Iraq in an American drone strike. Our Middle East editor Jeremy Byrne reports from the Iraqi capital, Baghdad.
The burial in Kerman, his hometown, was supposed to be the culmination of Iran's long goodbye to General Soleimani. Across Iran, millions have turned out to mourn, pray and shout their anger. Everywhere his coffin has been displayed. But the press and passion of the people was too much in Kerman, leading to the tragedy and the postponement of the general's burial. For Iranians, the deaths must surely add to the sense of crisis. The blame will be added to the American account. The Iranian Foreign Minister, Javed Zarif, said the US had refused his request for a visa to travel to the United Nations in New York. President Trump, he said, was not interested in de-escalating the crisis. And Dr. Zarif condemned the president's order to kill Qasem Soleimani.
That's an act of war done in a cowardly terrorist operation, and Iran will take appropriate response to that. De-escalation means the United States not taking further measures to stop threatening Iran, to apologize to Iranian nation. But the action by the United States has consequences. The end of U.S. presence in our region has already begun.
Iraq remains tense with real trepidation about what happens next. The talk of Iranian revenge and American retaliation is a terrifying prospect for Iraqis who've lived with war for most of their lives.
That report by Jeremy Bowen. Well, meanwhile, the US Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has defended the killing of General Soleimani, described by some as the second most powerful man in Iran. Speaking at a Washington news conference, Mr. Pompeo insisted that President Trump had taken the right decision when he authorized the drone strike against the general last Friday.
If you're looking for imminence, you needn't look no further than the days that led up to the strike that was taken against Soleimani. And then you, in addition to that, have what we could clearly see were continuing efforts on behalf of this terrorist to build out a network of campaign activities that were going to lead potentially to the death of many more Americans. It's the right decision. We got it right. The Department of Defense did excellent work. And the president had a entirely legal, appropriate, and a basis, as well as a decision that fit perfectly within our strategy.
I asked our Washington correspondent, Gary O'Donoghue, if more is now known about the intelligence that led the US to launch the airstrike.
In short, we don't. That may change, Valerie, in the coming hours, since the administration is planning on briefing the so-called Gang of Eight. That's sort of four Republicans and four Democrats in Congress, the leading figures in Congress, really, particularly from the intelligence committees, both houses. That may tell us more, or what leaks out of that briefing may tell us more. They're also planning to talk to the whole of Congress, in fact, give them some sort of behind closed doors briefing. That will necessarily be a lot more watered down, but still there may be some snippets to come out of that that we don't know already. But if there is, or if there was, some kind of imminent spectacular that was trying to be averted here, they're certainly not pointing us strongly in that direction at this stage.
And the Iraqi Prime Minister has said he got a signed copy of a letter promising US troops would be withdrawn from Iraq, but the US Defence Secretary has denied it. So what's going on?
Who knows? I mean, this letter came out yesterday. The Americans denied it in the shape of Mark Esper, the Defence Secretary, as you say, Joint Chiefs of Staff, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Mark Esper is on his feet as we speak at the moment at the podium in the Pentagon. He's just said the same thing again. He's not aware of any signed letter. Policy hasn't changed. America's not leaving Iraq. Goodness knows what's going on, frankly, in terms of the communication, because it's not a fake as such. They're not suggesting it's a complete fake. They're just saying it's a draft for discussion. So we really don't know at this stage what the plans are, because the original draft of that letter did talk about effectively US troops moving out of Iraq over a period of time and arrangements for them to do that. That's something, as I say, that's being denied again by Mark Esper. These Pentagon briefings, we didn't have any for about 2 years, and we've had about three in a day now, so a bit like London buses.
Gary O'Donoghue in Washington. And if you'd like to learn more about how Iran's relationship with the US has fluctuated over the years, you might enjoy the BBC Witness History Iran collection. It has first-hand accounts of the 1953 US-backed coup that brought the Shah to power, as well as voices from Iran's Islamic Revolution, stories from American embassy hostages, soldiers, students, musicians and diplomats. Just search online for BBC Witness History. Other news now. And Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has criticised one of the country's most senior religious figures, Rabbi Yitzhak Yosef, for calling Russian immigrants religion-hating Gentiles. John McManus reports.
Yitzhak Yosef is no stranger to controversy. In the past, he's been accused of calling black people monkeys. Now the leader of Israel's Sephardic Jews has criticised the country's law of return, which grants citizenship to Jewish immigrants, even if they aren't defined as Jewish under religious law. Rabbi Yosef said the law had allowed what he called masses of Gentiles to enter Israel, some of whom he said were communists, hostile to religion or haters of religion. Hundreds of thousands of immigrants from the former Soviet Union made their home in Israel after the end of the Cold War. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has condemned the comments, calling immigrants from former Soviet countries a blessing for Israel.
John McManus reporting. Now to the world of global currencies.
For over 40 years, we've been the world's leading global currency solutions provider. We have an unmatched presence in major airports and retail outlets. We'll take you further on your journey. Welcome to Travelex Currency Solutions.
And that's an excerpt from a video promoting the British-based foreign exchange company Travelex. It's emerged that hackers are now holding Travelex to ransom a week after it was devastated by a cyber attack, which meant that computer systems in 30 countries had to be switched off. Staff at its branches have been reduced to using pen and paper. I heard more from our cyber correspondent, Joe Tidy.
Well, the first we heard about this was just after the new year, when it was discovered and it was revealed that Travelex was the victim of what they were calling a malware attack, a cyber attack. They didn't give any details, and they still haven't given any details about what type of attack that was. And we now know from speaking to the Met Police and from other people in the information security industry that this is a ransomware attack, which means that hackers have gained access to Travelex's computer systems, and then they have launched their attack at a point of their choosing. I have since spoken to some hackers who are taking responsibility for this, and they say they are holding Travelex to ransom for $6 million US, and Travelex have 7 days to pay the money, or the hackers will release all the data that they've downloaded and delete all the files that are the back end of Travelex's system.
And what is this data? Is it customers' data?
We don't know. Travelex have said all along, they've said that no customer data has been compromised. What they haven't said is whether or not that data is in their control. So it may not have been compromised as in sold online or given out to the dark web. But it may be in the possession of the hackers, and it may be that they are in this situation where they are negotiating whether or not it will be released. The hackers tell me they have got date of births, credit card information, social security numbers. They even said they've got some driver's license details as well. They say they've downloaded 5 gigabits of data, which some cybersecurity experts have told me could amount to tens of millions of customer data.
And it seems extraordinary that these hackers are so confident they're not going to be traced, that they're talking to you, a journalist.
Yeah, and it surprised me that they would talk to me actually as well, because they are in what is a very criminal enterprise. They're earning lots and lots of money in a very illegal way. But this gang in particular, they've been going back years. They are linked to another gang, which was called Gand Crab. Apparently, they say, made up $1.6 billion doing exactly this sort of work. And now they've resurfaced, and they obviously, very plainly, see themselves as immune to any repercussions.
And what do the police say about this?
Well, the Met Police have said they are dealing with a ransomware incident. They are leading the investigation alongside TravelX. They said that they were contacted on the 2nd of January about this. They haven't given us any other details about this. What is surprising is how TravelX has responded to this. They haven't emailed any customers about what's going on. They haven't even admitted publicly that this is a ransomware attack. And they've remained extremely secretive about what's going on.
Are all companies vulnerable to this kind of attack? Because listening to it, it's absolutely terrifying.
Yes, what we're seeing, the trend in the last couple of years, this is a very highly targeted attack where the hackers have picked TravelX and they've spent a long time trying to probe and get inside the network, and they've succeeded. And every company is vulnerable to this. No matter how safe this and secure the network is, it's a case of how you respond once it happens.
Our cyber correspondent, Joe Tidy. Now news of another podcast from the BBC World Service.
For teenagers like me, it's hard to imagine a world where the tech we take for granted didn't exist.
We didn't have email back then. You know, everything was mail, or we didn't have internet.
So in our new podcast, Worldwise Web, 12 of us from around the world will be spending time with the people who invented it.
We believed someday everybody would have a cell phone.
Finding out how they came up with their ideas.
I'm always saying yes to the weirdest of things just so I can find all those crazy things in life that are really fun.
And asking for advice.
You've got to figure out what drives you. What makes you really happy? Do that.
That's Worldwise Web from the BBC World Service.
You have conducted probably one of the greatest interviews I've ever had.
To hear more about it, search for Worldwise Web wherever you get your podcasts.
Wow, okay, we are in a new world.
And look out for the first episode on the 10th of January.
Okay, bye. Thank you very much.
Now back to our global podcast, and next to Venezuela, where the country's opposition leader Juan Guaido has dramatically entered the National Assembly building in Caracas, despite being barred by security forces as his rival for the position of parliamentary speaker, Luis Parra, held a session. Inside the chamber, where the electricity was cut at one point, Mr. Guaido climbed the leader's podium. Where he sang a rousing version of the national anthem together with his political allies. The drama didn't end there. Mr. Guaido and his supporters were forced to shield themselves from volleys of tear gas fired by the security forces. James Kumarasamy spoke to the BBC's Guillermo Moreno, who was in the chamber, and described what he saw.
Well, what we saw, it's been a new day of tension in the Venezuelan National Assembly. Reporters gathered there and were expecting Mr. Guaido's arrival, as his rival, Luis Parra, was held in his meeting indoors. And at some point, the National Guard just shut down the building, preventing everybody from getting in or outside. So we were trying to film Mr. Guaido's coming in and to try to find out what was happening outside the fence. But the National Guard prevented us from doing so. But then Juan Guaido and his supporters arrived and struggled with the officers who were deployed around the fence, and eventually broke through and managed to make it into the building and to preside over a session of the National Assembly that was just held without electricity because the electricity had been cut off.
So who is the president of the National Assembly at the moment?
Well, that's hard to say. Actually, most experts and lawyers I've talked to claim that Luis Parra is an illegitimate president of the National Assembly. And I've been in the so-called session where he was, I would say, rather than elected, proclaimed by the government supporters. And as many people could see in the footage provided by TV stations, his rival, the other candidate, Juan Guaido, the opposition candidate, wasn't allowed in the chamber. So it's hard to say that Luis Parra is actually the president of the National Assembly.
Meanwhile, Venezuela has another president who presumably is looking at this with some glee, is he?
Well, there's another president in Venezuela, actually the one at the top, the one that everybody thinks holds power yet, who is Nicolas Maduro. And there are a lot of clues hinting that the government approved and pushed Luis Parra as a new president of the National Assembly. But what it's controversial is the way he has won that presidency. Many people say that Nicolas Maduro is an illegitimate government, and many people are now claiming that Luis Parra is also an illegitimate president of the National Assembly.
But briefly, this shows that Mr. Guaido really is having, still has a lot of roadblocks in the way if he wants to take real power.
Yeah, that's a tough way ahead for him. Actually, he's now fighting for keeping the last stronghold of power he holds, which is the National Assembly. It looks too difficult that he might at any time soon push Nicolás Maduro out of power. Actually, he's now defending his position.
Guillermo Moreno in Venezuela. A court in the Indian capital Delhi has announced that four men convicted in a high-profile gang rape and murder case will be executed in 2 weeks' time. More from Yogita Lamai in Delhi.
The court has set a date for the execution. The men are convicted of gang raping and murdering a woman in Delhi in 2012. The brutality with which she was raped shocked the country. Thousands came out on the streets in cities across India demanding better safety for women. And in response, the government was compelled to make stricter laws.
Yogita Lamai in India. Today, there are more forcibly displaced people globally than at any time since the end of the Second World War. More than half of them are children with a complex range of educational needs. So, how should they be educated and given opportunities to thrive in their new communities? A group of policymakers, teachers and experts recently met in the Austrian city of Salzburg for a global seminar to propose recommendations. Bethany Bell reports.
Refugee children from Burundi at a school in a camp in Rwanda. Ella Inahazwe, who is herself a Burundian refugee, works as a counsellor for refugee children in Eastern Africa who want to go to university. She says education means hope.
Education is really helping them to avoid being hopeless, and it's also connecting families. Education is connecting students who are in camps with the host communities, and education is also connecting them with the world, what's happening outside, because when they are in camps, they don't know really what's happening outside.
Play, yeah, number two. Play. Music room.
A class for Syrian children in Lebanon. Many refugees have experienced conflicts and violence, which can make learning even harder. Danielle de la Fuente is the director of the AMEL Alliance, which provides social and emotional learning for refugee children.
Social emotional learning is essentially teaching things such as kindness and compassion and empathy, showing children how to balance and regulate their emotions. Unfortunately, because of all the conflicts and global strife, children have been displaced. And from that, they've experienced tremendous trauma, chronic stress, and are having challenges learning or may not even have access to learning opportunities. So social emotional learning is really key because one, it just prepares a child to learn, and it also opens an opportunity for them to build their social emotional competencies, life skills, and other aspects to help heal the trauma.
Rohingya refugee children at lessons in a camp in Bangladesh. Kirk Person is an expert on minority language issues who works with SIL International. He says it's very important to support children in their first language.
We know from studies all over the world in both developed and developing countries that if you have a strong base, a strong literacy skills in your mother tongue or your first language, the language which the child speaks best, that learning other languages becomes much easier. But what often happens now is a refugee child might be put in a situation where suddenly not only are they torn away from their home and their community, if they have the chance of education, it's probably coming in a language they don't even know. So unintentionally, this can further marginalize them, further put them behind in their educational development.
Rohingya children at a refugee camp in Bangladesh, ending that report from Bethany Bell. The World Health Organization has called for additional funding to help stop a measles outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo, which has killed more than 6,000 people over the last year. Will Ross reports.
Huge efforts are being made to try to stop the world's worst ever measles outbreak. 18 million children under the age of five have been vaccinated, but the World Health Organization says that's not nearly enough. The problem is, in the Democratic Republic of Congo, it's incredibly hard to reach everyone. The country's huge and the infrastructure poor. The WHO says weak public health systems and insecurity have also hampered the response. In Congo, measles has killed close to three times as many people as the Ebola virus, which has attracted far more attention. The global health body says it needs $40 million to stop more people dying.
Will Ross. The governor of Puerto Rico has declared a state of emergency after the U.S. territory suffered its most powerful earthquake for a century. Wanda Vasquez has also called up the National Guard and appealed for residents to remain calm. About a third of the Caribbean island is without running water and many homes are without electricity because of damage to a power station. The governor confirmed that one person had died. The latest quake, with a magnitude of 6.4, struck just off the south coast early on Tuesday. Diviaria heard more from Melina Aguiar, a tour guide in Ponce in the south of Puerto Rico.
Right now I'm in Ponce, which is about 30 minutes from the nearest town where the earthquake actually took place, which is near to Juanica and Guayanilla. This morning around 4:30 a.m., we got hit by an earthquake, which was felt all over the island, but not only affecting the whole island, but destroying a lot of structures, especially in the southern part of the island. We know for sure over 100 houses have fallen or been destroyed, and many more right now are in danger of falling. We're right now still in shock because the earthquake aftermath are still being felt every minute. We get some kind of shake, and it's still not very stable to enter any structure that has suffered any damage.
And of course, the one structure that a lot of people have been concerned about is the Punta Ventana. Tell our global listeners why that is so significant and what the damage has been like.
Well, in Punta Ventana is a very famous view rock formation that we have in the municipality of Guayanilla. And people were, especially in shock in this region because it is a tourist destination point. It was a beautiful structure. You could go there hiking and see the nature of that. And it was one of the first things that we lost due to the earthquake yesterday, which was 5.7, category 5.7. So due to the earthquake yesterday, that was one of the first structures that we lost. Today, we have lost even more. It's just we haven't been able to find out yet. But yesterday in particular, that structure, Punta Ventana, is a symbol of many of the people of Guayanilla, which is a town that's being hit the most closest to where the earthquake's epicentrum is happening.
Melina Aguiar, a tour guide in Puerto Rico. An unimaginably vast area where stars are forming has been discovered tens of thousands of light years away in the Milky Way, the galaxy that contains our solar system. The area, named the Radcliffe Wave, consists of gas and is the largest structure of its kind. It was named after the institute at Harvard University, where the astronomers who found it are from. Our science correspondent Paul Rincon told me more.
So it's about 9,000 light years long, which is an incredible distance. That's trillions of kilometres long. And all along it, you have these very bright stars that basically, as the gas pressure goes out of sync with the gravity in the gas, it collapses and forms these stars. So it's located along one of the spiral arms of our galaxy. So the Milky Way is a spiral galaxy, which is a bit like when you stir your cup of coffee with a bit of cream in it. It forms these kind of little filament structures around the edges. And that's where we're located, the solar system's located.
How excited are astronomers about this? I mean, does this change the way we should view where we are in the solar system?
Yes, it does, because this discovery grew out of an attempt to use this new telescope.
Gaia. Together,
Gaia, yes. You use Gaia's capabilities, which are to measure distances from our star to other stars very, very accurately. They knew about these star-forming regions and these stellar nurseries, but they thought they were sort of arranged in a ring around the sun. We now know that that ring is actually a long, straight filament of gas. And, you know, perhaps we'll find more structures like this as they do the work and they look further out into the Milky Way and really map the Milky Way in a very precise way. But for now, this is a really kind of interesting structure that will teach us a lot about star formation, how stars form, and by extension, how our own solar system formed.
Paul Rincon. The BAFTAs are the biggest film and television awards here in Britain, and this year's nominations have just been announced, with the film Joker, directed by Todd Phillips, leading the pack.
And finally, in a world where everyone thinks they can do my job, check out this guy.
When I was a little boy and told people I was going to be a comedian, everyone laughed at me. Well, no one's laughing now.
You can say that again, pal.
But the nominations have been criticised, with BAFTA admitting there's an infuriating lack of diversity. The American actresses Scarlett Johansson and Margot Robbie, both white, have received two nominations each. Our entertainment correspondent Lisa Mazimba reports.
For the seventh year in a row, the Best Director shortlist is all male. And although in recent years many performances from ethnic minority actors and actresses have been recognised, this year none of the acting nominees come from diverse backgrounds. Mia Bays is an award-winning producer who now runs a charity that tackles inequality in the industry. She believes that today shows that the BAFTAs aren't really about rewarding talent.
One always just builds up hope. And I thought it was a really strong year for diverse talent and that actually we would get a better showing at the BAFTAs. But actually, change happens on the edges, and BAFTAs just a deeply conventional group of people who really are very, very Hollywood beholden. And so nothing really surprises me either.
Many, including BAFTA's chief executive Amanda Berry, say they're disappointed with the gender balance and ethnic makeup of today's list. She says they're working hard to achieve better balance in the wider film world.
It's not that BAFTA isn't doing anything in this arena. We're actually probably doing more than any other academy globally in terms of finding those talented individuals and supporting them. And we will continue to do more. I think we have to.
BAFTA's last diversity survey in 2015 indicated that around 13% of its members were from minority ethnic groups and that 41% were women, figures it hopes have been improving since then. Today's nominations mean that there'll certainly be more attention paid to something that is recognised to be an industry-wide issue, not one that's just confined to awards ceremonies.
Our entertainment correspondent Lisa Mazimba reporting there. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.